This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris and Kusu Chuang. You know it's a Friday when Chuang is on air with us.
It is.
Okay, it is
happy the... Happy day.
Happy day, okay. It's the 4th of May, and we're just after... We're coming out after 6 o'clock. This is the hour. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of interviews, news, and analysis. So stay tuned. It's going to be an exciting trip all morning long. Now, let's begin with some interesting news. It's partly environmental and what we're doing to the environment, which is an Indian dust storm. Well, it's a dust storm in India, to be more precise. And it's killed some 100 people in Uttar Pradesh and Rajasthan. Now, of course, I think the one thing we can all agree upon is that Malaysia seems to be exempt from many natural disasters, even those occurring in the region.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the last one that had any kind of note was the earthquake in Kota Kinabalu, in fact, Mount Kinabalu, which in fact was also isolated. It doesn't really happen earthquakes to Malaysia.
That's right.
No typhoons, no hurricanes, no gales, no earthquakes.
We're lucky that way. We have some flooding.
Some of it's due to poor management, but generally we don't have the kind of natural disasters we see in the rest of the world. But some of, because disasters are man-made in India, Indian cities, interesting enough, 14 out of the top 20 most polluted cities in the world are in India. And India has a huge environmental problem.
Well, what do you think it is? I mean, is it the industrialization? Is it because there's a lot more development or a lack of, you know, environmental measures to manage the pollution?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's that. There's also this...
The density of people, because China has
the sheer mass
problem,
of people.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, you know, Delhi's got, what, 15, 16 million people. All of them are on motorcycles, and there's cows, and there's animals, and there's humans, and there's all kinds of stuff.
But, you know, I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but there's this... It's a developing world complex, right, that you have to kind of go through the environmental pollution and destruction, whereas the developed world have already gone through this. I mean, they went through the air pollution crisis way back when, but now they've moved beyond that. So is it just kind of a passage that countries have to go through in order to get developed?
Well, you know, think of this, and I'm just going to mention some of the cities, other cities, non-Indian cities that are also on the top 20 list. Ulaanbaatar.
In Mongolia.
Is one of the top. So thinking, some of the cities I don't even know, Liaocheng. But when you think of Jodhpur, Jaipur, I mean, these are, you know, also not huge cities. It is one thing. I think there is a question of, I mean, political will is one, but also how people see the environment. There are a lot of Asian cultures where you only look after your own little compound and you don't care about the public.
You know, the other day
it's kind of a dumping area.
Yeah, I was following behind this car the other day, and you know, this guy was smoking and he just chucked a cigarette out when he was finished. Then the other day I was behind a lorry and he just finished his bag of crisps and he just lobbed it out the window.
You should honk them.
I did. Yeah. I drove past the guy, accelerated past, and I pointed at the thing and I said, and I gesticulated basically to pick it up. And you know what? You know what he did? He gave me... He showed me part of his anatomy on his hand.
Okay. All right. Yeah, one of the many fingers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So what? But, you know, look, I live in a reasonably nice neighborhood, you know, and people dump things in our parks, you know, on the streets. And I just wonder, why is it that even in a leafy neighborhood like mine, people care so little about
it's their homes after all, right?
Yeah. Mm. It is, but they don't see it that way. They see the street outside their gates as something other than themselves for which they have no they have no stake in and they don't care about. You know, so within their fences it's all very neat and nice. Beyond it,
yeah.
So how do you change that? How do you make people care about common spaces?
I actually don't know.
It comes from within. I think there's enough realization from within, you know, then things should change.
Or like you're invested in the space, right?
Yeah,
you should be invested because you live there.
And then you understand that everything's connected. You know, I was in Tumpat last year, right, in Kelantan. I went for the International Kite Festival with my kids.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful part of the world. But then on the beach, just fronting the town centre, it was the most disgusting place. There was nappies, there was diapers, there was tampons, used tampons, you know, Milo packets. It was just terrible. And this is their village, their town, their beach, you know.
So what is it and how much do we care about these? Tell us what you think is going behind a lack of concern for public spaces, especially in terms of cleanliness. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Remember, if you want to be anonymous, don't put your name there. But if you don't want to be anonymous, if you want a bit of a shout out, please put your name to your WhatsApp. We'll be back with a look at why men are so bad at friendships. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris and Kusu Chuang. That was Kim Carnes with Betty Davis Eyes, because a very familiar voice from us who were rocking and rolling in the 80s.
Baby, okay. Come on.
Have you guys seen the video for that, for Betty Davis? It's the best 80s video ever. It's so 80s. I love it.
A smoky lens and hairspray?
Well, a lot, and a lot of choreographed dancing in groups. It's brilliant.
It's really like Sharad dancing,
shoulder
actually.
Pads. Well, you know, Kim Carnes is 72 years old year. Yeah. And if Karl Marx was alive, he'd be 200 years old tomorrow. Karl Marx. And actually, there are celebrations around the world for the 200th anniversary of his birth. It's happening in many countries, including, you interviewed Blanko Milanovic,
yes.
And he mentioned it on Twitter yesterday, and he said he's going to Haifa in Israel for a conference, because there are many conferences around the world talking about the influence of Karl Marx. There's a new movie about the young Karl Marx as well.
Wow, so that's your celebration. Today is May the 4th, so May the 4th be with you. That's a bit more my celebration.
Star Wars.
Pop culture a little bit.
Yeah, it has contributed to the intellectual life of so many.
It's kind of like my speed as well, sure.
You know, yeah, you're right.
Who would have thunk Marx, right?
Okay.
A quick note from Anne Tan, who weighed in on WhatsApp about our conversation about the environment.
Right. That's right. She says, it baffles me how little Malaysians care about the cleanliness of the environment. They do complain about dog poo, though, and dog hair. I guess some people do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's look at the complaints that we have about each other. In this case, the question of whether men make bad friends, whether they provide less emotional support, have lower levels of self-disclosure and trust than any other types of relationships you'll have. So if you have a relationship with a man, you're likely not to get this in oodles. Is that true?
So initially when I saw this story on Quartz, Sharad, I, you know, kind of like the gut instinct is to deny it, right? Because I'm a great friend. I've got tons of mates and all that. But then when you read the story, you kind of realize that there's a grain of truth to this. Because
what do you mean?
Because men, and you know, I'm part of quite a few groups, you know, being the society
like
person
manly
that I am.
Groups.
Exactly, right?
Mates, okay.
What are you revealing on air?
It's very superficial. Right?
Oh.
Yeah, buddies and bros and mates and all that. It doesn't enter the whole emotional needs, problem space.
Okay.
The kind of stuff that we discuss is like, you know, your typical stuff, sports, beers, boxing, whatever, right?
Well, that's fine.
But that's fine.
That's fine,
but
too.
But that's level one stuff. The level two stuff, the level three stuff, the stuff that makes them scared at night, the stuff that makes them afraid, the stuff that gives them sleepless nights. Very rarely gets
well,
discussed.
It's fine to talk about the level one stuff, as you put it, Chuang, but do you get to the level three, four, five?
No.
I mean, do you get to the point, so after a couple of drinks with your mates, do you get to the point where you say, this is what's keeping me up at night,
I found that in my interactions with my mates, right, sometimes when I try and broach these issues, there is a wall that comes up. It's, oh, you know, don't be so
maudlin.
Expletive.
Why do you think that?
I don't know.
I think maybe it's a question of comfort, right? So if men are not used to sharing their inner thoughts and feelings, if they've been taught to always project a strong exterior, never to be vulnerable, to be... And I think there's something about Asian societies. And if they model themselves on their fathers, for instance, as the kind of primary male model, who also was that, you know, he was the breadwinner, he was strong, he was decisive, he never showed vulnerability, he broke no dissent, he, you know, smacked you across the face if you'd said something, you know, that he didn't agree with, then because that's going to be the model that you're going to take through life.
Yeah, I
look at my dad sometimes and, you know, he has his ups and downs and all that. And he always said, you know, my shoulders are broad enough to take anything that comes my way. And he never really shared anything with us in terms of the stuff that made him afraid. Or he always says, I'm not afraid of anything. And, you know, he was always very... manly that way.
You had that notion of masculinity. But why do you think it's different for women or for girls, though? Because to be completely honest with you, you know, this is, I feel without that kind of the need to connect with my girlfriends, I definitely have days where all I want to do is vent to someone, and that's where you have the your support group of your friends, and you know it's we tell each other our deepest, darkest secrets and our fears and what's going on with our personal lives, and it's really wonderful to be able to share that.
I'm quite astounded because sometimes when I'm you know the kind of stuff that my wife talks about with her mates is completely bare bones and in the core, you know what I mean?
But also expressing love because one of my best friends had a birthday the other day, and I, in a crowded area, hugged her, kissed her and said, I love you. And then the table next to us were staring at us like we were aliens. And I found that bizarre because it was just an expression of my love for her and our friendship. And yeah, and the couple of guys next door was like, because we were crying as well. And
That's but you know, I must say that I guess every family is unique. And in my family, my father actually displayed quite a bit of vulnerability, and he was the much more kind of open personality. Whereas my mother, I think, was always showed herself to a projected the strong exterior, resilient woman who could take you know the tough reversals in her life. And I think you know. And that may be partly a consequence of my parents' divorce. But I do think that we have different experiences of men and women, and perhaps we model ourselves on them.
You know, but one thing, there's a recent survey that says that it takes about 100 hours to make a new friend. So,
really?
Yeah.
I could do it in an hour. I could do it in an hour.
So 100 hours, not consecutively, 40, of course.
Well, if you're Australian, it takes one beer. And
So about 60 hours for a casual friendship, 100 hours to be upgraded to a friend, and 200 hours to become best friends.
It takes me a long time to trust somebody to become a mate.
Much more than 200 hours.
Much more,
okay, somebody who's might have lost the friendship of many recently is the Uber entrepreneur Elon Musk. And we're going to come back and look at what he said to questions posed to him. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. The Beatles with Tomorrow Never Knows. Because a classic from its time. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris and Kusu Chuang, classics from their time as well. Okay, thank you so much for being part of this conversation this morning.
Thank you for it.
You can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. Tima Kinta, or Dr. Fu as we know him, he's tweeted and said, Tesla, not Uber, hashtag Elon Musk. Yes, of course, Elon Musk is with Tesla, but I used the Uber with the small U's, like Uber, like in the German, like super, super entrepreneur, Dr. Fu. Thank you so much for weighing in on that issue. Now, interestingly enough, Elon Musk has made some unusual choices throughout his life, and this is the latest is no different. He is chose to veto boring questions during Tesla's latest earnings call.
Okay, so at this earnings call, you've got a whole bunch of analysts in the room, and you've got Elon Musk on stage taking questions, right? But the journalists kept asking financial questions to Elon Musk, and Elon, as he's known to you and I, found that boring. So he actually said, boring, bonehead questions are not cool. Next, in that tone. But it just speaks to me that he's not interested in speaking about the financials of it. I guess what he was looking for essentially were questions about how he was going to, what he was going to do with his company. So he's not interested in the nitty gritty of how a company works. He wants to talk big picture stuff. So he finds these questions, to quote him, bonehead, boring bonehead.
Yeah, this kind of demonstrates a whole founder professional manager conundrum, right? When you're one of these really smart guys and you start a company and you're essentially a geek and you're an IT guy, and you take it to a point where it goes public and you've got public shareholders and all that, but then you've got to also feel the financial questions, because that's part of your remit as a CEO. The thing is, I heard the call. It was on the Wall Street Journal, right?
Oh, was it? Was it a conference call? And
It was kind of like a conference call. Yeah. So the guy from Morgan Stanley calls up and he says, "Hey, look, Elon, look, I mean, it was basically capital requirements, right? Because they've been burning through cash like there's no tomorrow. And the latest earnings was basically a bigger cash loss. It was a bigger loss than the previous calendar quarter. So they basically burned through $1.4 billion of losses in just 6 months, right? So basically, you know, will you raise more capital to fund this expansion? Fair question, right? Fair question. And he just goes, oh, boring, bonehead questions. And the thing is, you know, you want to answer questions on tech, for sure, right? You're a tech guy, but you're now CEO of a Wall Street listed company.
So do you think that, okay, so I'm kind of in two minds about this, because there are some times where some journalists tend to ask questions that are either very obvious or in the statement. And then I can see that perhaps the CEO, the person being interviewed, is getting irritated or getting really bored with that line of questioning. But I think there needs to be a bit of a balance of the two. You can't always just talk about big picture stuff. You might need to talk about the financials, because that's what concerns shareholders.
Yeah, and it's a question of mutual respect, right? I mean, in some ways, Elon Musk has to recognize what journalists are doing. They have a professional duty. They, you know, and where they come from, you know, maybe marks the kind of questions they'll be asking if they're from a financial newspaper, as opposed to, you know, some other type of media outlet. In fact, if you look at the story that we're going to be tweeting out to you, he took 10 questions from one fella who goes by the very interesting name of Galileo Russell.
Wow. This is Buddy, a YouTube vlogger.
Right? Yeah. So you go to and you give people the space because that's the platform you like. But there are other platforms, and if you respected them, I think what we do know from Elon Musk is that he makes short shrift of other people. I don't know if he's the kind of guy that respects others.
Really? You think so? Just to note, though, it was analysts, right? So not quite journalists. It was an analyst call. So these guys essentially, all they look at is the business of it, right? So the financials and the earnings. So I think you should have expected that the line of questioning would skew financial.
You know, going back to what you're saying about dumb journalist questions, right?
They're
lazy journalists and they're dumb journalists.
Right?
But that's spade a spade,
right? I've been part of these press conferences and some of these questions, I mean, my goodness, you want to walk over there and bop the guy between the eyes, because it's just useless question. No research, no preparation.
And not even listening.
Not even listening.
The guy may have answered it in the last 10 minutes.
But communications rule number one, no question is too stupid to answer, right?
That's right.
And I've been part of AGMs, right, for example. I don't want to cite this example. He's now a Tan Sri, right? Wahid Omar. Amazing guy, right? The most patient, the most professional guy. And, you know, some shareholders ask the most stupid questions, right? And this guy, you know, Wahid Omar, he was in charge of telecom at the time, gave this guy a proper 1.5 minute answer.
Oh, good.
Yeah. You know, so that's the rule book.
With due respect, right? Yeah.
Okay. And thank you again for weighing in on this conversation. Remember, you can be part of it by tweeting us or WhatsApping us. And no shame to you, Dr. Fu, who's tweeted and saying, Alamak, malu saya maaf. No need.
About the Uber entrepreneur.
Well, taking you up to the first bulletin of the morning. Sabrina Maglin is poised at the mic to give it to you. But before she does, there's the Red Hot Chili Peppers with Under the Bridge. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Smiths with their 1986 hit Cemetery Gates. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Melissa Idris and Kusu Chuang. And the morning run continues. It's just 40 minutes after 6 in the morning. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of interviews, news and analysis. It is the 4th of May, or May the 4th be with you. I can't even say it with a straight face.
May the 4th be with you.
May the 4th be with you.
And the revenge of the 6th comes later.
Over the weekend. Okay. Brilliant music by the Smiths. One of my favorite bands when I was at university. And I was actually at university in the middle of the 80s. Some of you might have been children swaddling and sort of diapers and nappies and such. Okay, speaking about our youth, many of us have siblings, and there are special relationships, some of them good, sometimes they can turn bad. Now, the question is, how far do we carry those relationships and those relationship dynamics into our adult life? Some of it, and we see playing out in the upcoming general election. We see it with Azwan Ali, the brother of Azmin Ali, the Menteri Besar of Selangor, or at least the caretaker Menteri Besar of Selangor. We also see it in the past side of the story between Nick Abdul and Nick Omar, sons of the late Tok Guru Nick Aziz.
Yeah, but I mean, these two different sibling rivalries or political rivalries now come from different places, I think. With the with Nick Abdul and Nick Omar, really that's about the legacy of their father, right? What is Nick Aziz's legacy and who is seen to be the bearer of that legacy? With Azwan Ali and Azmin Ali, that's a more, I guess, public and about visibility and popularity. Azwan Ali, of course, you know, a huge name in the entertainment industry. So he's really kind of front and center. What, Diva AA, right? So who doesn't know him in Malaysia? So it's really about, I guess, the glitz. And you know, it was funny. I was on my way to nomination day to kind of look at the nomination day coverage. And the Grab drivers were all telling me that the only seat they were watching was the Bukit Antarabangsa seat because of what was happening there. And they said, oh, that's, you know, it's on everyone's Facebook page that Azwan Ali is going against his brother.
Yeah, look, I mean, I, you know, obviously I'm not a big fan of local, well, not a big consumer of local entertainment, so I don't know quite how big Azwan Ali is, but...
Big.
Is yeah. He's massive, is he? Yeah. But he's the rendang guy, right?
He matches his sunglasses.
Yeah,
he's that
yeah.
big.
He did Melody, if I'm not mistaken, back in the day when I was growing up.
So he's quite famous for doing the rendang thing a couple of days ago, right? And he's standing for as an independent for one of the seats.
Yeah, so I guess that the issue really with sibling rivalries that most of us can relate to this. I do think with the Azwan Ali, Azmin Ali, you know, dynamic, I'm not entirely sure what's behind it. It's like I wish I was a fly on the wall.
During Raya.
Not during Raya, but when they were kids and wondering, is this got to do with how their parents treated them and whether, you know, there was favoritism or was this feeling that, you know, and sometimes extroverts, if you notice, extroverts often are kids who felt they needed some visibility in their home. Maybe they were sidelined. And
really?
So, and they come out and so they have to, you know, you had to perform much more if you were, in some families at least.
Yeah, I mean, the other sibling rivalry that didn't emerge in this particular talk was the Nazir and Najib sibling rivalry, right? Because obviously Nazir is going off on a
Understated that
a
one.
Bit more understated, but you know, Nazir has got this Instagram account who's he's quite tangential in his postings, but you get the impression that the two brothers are going in different directions.
That's true. Also, we also have Sharil Samad and Khalid Samad, one from UMNO, one from PAS. That's also another sibling rivalry. Jenny Lasimbang, and I think she's got a relative she's running. This is in Sabah. Daryl Leaking with another relative, also in Sabah. But one gets the impression, at least from the peninsula, that a lot of people in Sabah are related to each other.
Are you saying something?
Well,
I don't think that.
I don't think that's fair. It's like everyone in Penang knows each other, right?
Kind of. Kind of related
like
to
that.
Each other.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, I do want to kind of explore this. What... I wonder what that's like to, and how you get there. How do siblings who, let's just say, perhaps you know, were close growing up, how do they end up having very different political views? And what happens in the political arena when you have to go up against, you know, against your sibling? Is it all bets are off, and then later at, you know, the family reunion, you kind of hug and kiss and forget about whatever dirty tricks politics may have made you play? So I'm quite curious to see for me, it's so outside of my world. I'm wondering what those dynamics are like.
Yeah, obviously you're referring to the Nick Abdul and the Nick Omar.
But everyone, right?
So
if you have a different political leaning than I do, then what is that conversation like at the dinner
table?
Yeah,
at the dinner table, is it just silence?
Don't talk about politics.
And because we're going to be moving into the season of Ramadan straight after the elections, and that's going to be...
Season for forgiveness.
It is a season for forgiveness, and the question is whether we can go beyond the formal gestures of forgiveness towards something quite genuine. We'll be back with a look at the investigation into Dr. Mahathir allegedly for spreading fake news. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Something So Wrong by Crowded House. That was a hit from 1986. We seem to be stuck in 1986. I think it was a great year. I was just 20 years old.
At the prime of your life.
Well, I think at 52, I'm still in my prime, I'd like to believe. Okay. Now, we move to the story that's, I think, fascinated quite a number of people, because we had the passing of the anti-fake news law most recently in the last parliamentary session, and it's been used once now against a Danish national. Now it looks like the police are investigating Pakatan Harapan leader Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad under the same law for suggestions that he made that his plane was sabotaged. Now the question is, you know, are we likely to see him charged? And he's in fact calling for the authorities to charge him, says, you know, bring it on.
Yeah, so this is really quite interesting. I'd like to see how this case pans out, simply because with the Danish national, Sharad, what we know of that case, that being the very first case being under this new law, it's not quite representative, I think, of how future cases could pan out, simply because the man who was charged under this Anti-Fake News Act, he wasn't legally represented. So he didn't have legal representation. He may not have known what it was he was pleading guilty to. As I understand it, I think he said something along the lines of, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to offend anyone, or something like that, and therefore at an admission of guilt. So it could be that that is one, the first case. We don't have case history of this, so we wouldn't know how the case, the act could be applied to in the future. So this case under Dr. Mahathir with the sabotage claims, seeing how that pans out will be very interesting. It'll set the tone of how the anti-fake news law is seen to be applied, whether that will be selective prosecution or via others.
Yeah, the whole Danish case was a bit bizarre, because it kind of made me think that perhaps, you know, the powers that be are trying to soften the ground for future cases in terms of, you know, putting a case out there. And it was a bit of a red herring, in my opinion. But the thing is, you know how the government always said the fake news bill and the fake news act was actually not meant to stifle opposition politics? It was also always meant for internet slander and things like that. So, and then you've also got the added dimension, because Dr. M's assertions that his plane was sabotaged made me think of the, you know, aviation disasters that have happened in the past. And do you remember 1976 when Fuad Stevens, the chief minister of Sabah, and I think nine of his other top brass in the Sabah government, died, right, tragically in a plane crash. And then you had DRB's Tan Sri Yahya, who also went down. And then you also had more recently Tan Sri Jamaluddin Jajus also went down. And so, you know, obviously all these issues came to mind.
So I'm going to be quite clear in terms of differentiating the Anti-Fake News Act and other acts, which include the Printing Presses Act, the Multimedia Communications Act, and everything that covers defamation. So defamation could be different, right? So claims of, say, sabotage and defamation and damage to a company's reputation, that is different than the Anti-Fake News Act, which says it's false information. And the Anti-Fake News Act doesn't make a differentiation between opinion and false information. So anything to do with data, reports, information, that doesn't actually say opinion. So if you say, well, in my opinion, and then you list a long laundry list of things that may not be correct, technically, that doesn't fall under the Act.
Yeah, so this question of what constitutes wholly or partly false information, what is the difference between opinion, speculation, and such, is something that, that in fact, I think the critics of the anti-fake law news point to. The flabbiness of the wording of the law makes it open to abuse, and that's the issue. And in fact, we turn to constitutional lawyer Newsin Yu for his thoughts on this case.
An opinion would be a form of information, wouldn't it? The problem we have here is the words that are used in the Act are so sweepingly broad that we have difficulties ascertaining what type of speech that are not caught under the Act. This is highly problematic, because falsehoods are inevitable in certain types of speech. For example, political satire or comedy. If there's no falsehood in such forms of speeches, it probably wouldn't be as funny. Yet it is all caught under the Act. So my simple answer to that is that there is in fact no distinction.
That was constitutional lawyer Niu Sin Yu discussing the distinction between opinion and news reports. Because reflecting on the recent news that Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad is being investigated under the new anti-fake news law. The outcomes of which, as Melissa, you pointed out, is going to set the tone for how the law is used, I think, in the future. At least that's the expectation.
That is true. And I also want to see, so what we just heard in the clip with the constitutional lawyer Niu Sin Yu, he said, how do you determine what speech is allowed? Because at the end of the day, while this act has been passed, you really have to look at the constitutionality of the act, right? What we are, our freedom of expression is protected under Article 10 1A, which does give us a right for freedom of expression. However, at what part does this act, I mean, where's that balance, where's that fine line that this act may or may not impede upon?
Okay, we're coming up to the top of the hour. We'll have the news bulletin, and then we'll be back with more news and analysis. Taking us there, the Get Up Kids with Stay Gone. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. May the 4th be with you. I'm Darth Vader. With me, Luke Skywalker, and Princess Leia chuckling away.
Love it.
Okay. Sharad Kutin and Melissa Idris, Kusu Chuang.
That's literally the theme song that plays in my head when I see you walk in the door every morning.
Breathing very heavily. Now, we're going to come to a Twitter poll we put out yesterday. Are you a fence-sitter, we asked, and a couple of hundred of you have weighed in. 78% say no. You're not on the fence when it comes to who you're going to vote for this election. 22% say yes, and that's pretty interesting. It's higher than I would have expected.
Well, that's higher than what the Merdeka Center found, because apparently the Merdeka Center found about 13-15% of voters at this point in time, actually when they did the survey, I think it was May 1st, were still fence sitters. What was really interesting for me was that, I thought that figure was in line with my expectations. But we also saw Invoke, which is also another think tank, they said that the figure was much higher. So I guess a fifth of people not deciding is still quite high.
But it's I think our methodology, I mean, we're using Twitter and it's not just random sampling, right?
Correct.
So people have said, well, Merdeka Center's surveys, based on whatever, 700 so or 1,500 so, but methodologically, statistically, you can still, if you get your techniques right, you can actually do a good test of the ground.
Well, I don't know about these surveys. I mean, remember when Brexit happened and remember the Donald Trump Clinton thing happened, all of these surveys. I think Oliver the Octopus would be more accurate sometimes.
Yeah, but usually he's asked only very simple questions
on
like
World Cup and
who's going to win. Yeah. He's got a 50-50 chance of getting it correct then. Now, okay. Well, one of the things that we've been talking about, and on Monday we had a discussion on the Breakfast Grill about whether this contest essentially is about the Malay ground. Because the Malay ground is not the monolith that it might seem if we use those kinds of expressions. But yet there are dynamics within the Malay community that are setting up the stage for the upcoming contest. Now, one of them is about surveys that have shown that support has swung from from PAS, the Islamic Party, which used to, people presumed had a solid 20% support within the community, was seen as stable. Now, that support apparently has swung towards Pakatan Harapan, towards PKR, and the component parties of Pakatan Harapan. Now, we turned to Merdeka Center's program director, Ben Sufian, and asked him if candidates are a factor in this swing.
I think in part it might be the candidate, but also people started putting some serious thought about the choices that they are going to make. Second, I think we noticed a swing from PAS towards PH, not so much from Barisan. I think the Barisan number is quite stable, but the swing from PAS to PH, I think suddenly people realized that they are making good their intention to contest in so many seats nationwide. And I think some voters who were inclined to pass began to have second thoughts about the party. So that might have resulted in the swing away from PAS towards PH.
Well, one of the states that we're watching is Johor. So we asked Ben what significance of Johor in terms of the Malay voter support.
Well, I mean, Johor is an interesting state because for the longest time, Johor, together with Sabah and Sarawak, is seen as the Barisan National Safe Deposit. And largely because it is the birthplace of UMNO and the place where political support for UMNO has been very, very high. But I think in recent times, this support might have been eroded because of economic factors as well as political issues that has affected the country. And in Johor, we notice that there is a significant decline in overall support for the ruling party there. But the support levels overall is still significantly large. And it is quite uphill for the opposition to make an attempt in taking the state. But then again, you know, there is a decline, and I think it emboldens the opposition to move forward.
Some of them would tip the scales to Pakatan's favour in Johor. I think Ben thinks that overcoming competition is going to be vital.
Well, I think the challenge for Pakatan is to overcome the voter support for other parties like PAS. I mean, PAS is a relatively recent entrant to Johor politics. And even in the past two or three elections, the Islamic Party rarely achieved more than 15% of the popular vote. And given that, for Pakatan to make a serious inroads in Johor, it really needs to win over PAS supporters, so people who are already not supporting Barisan Nasional. And then second, it has to win over the marginal Malay vote in Johor. I think these are not an easy task to achieve, but perhaps if they apply themselves, if they put more people to work on the ground in the next few days, maybe, who knows, they can make a difference.
Now, if you've been to some of the rallies in Ceramah, they talk about Tsunami Rakyat, but analysts have been more focused on a segment of the Rakyat, that is the Malay community. And so the question really that we put to Ben is whether there is a Malay tsunami, if he thinks the determining factor in this is going to, whether this is going to determine the outcome of GE14.
I mean, overall, we wouldn't call it a tsunami, you know, because it is not a nationwide phenomenon. It is very limited to certain parts of the states that we are seeing. While we can say that, yes, there is a decline, an expected decline, in support for the ruling party, it is not uniform. It is high in some places, and in some places, you know, the Barisan is actually improving in terms of support, particularly in places like Kelantan and Terengganu. So what we've noticed is, yeah, there isn't a uniform national pattern. It's more state-based and centered around leaders and personalities that can mobilize public and popular support.
That was Merdeka Center's Ben Sufian with his analysis on the Malay vote, which some surveys are suggesting has swung post-nomination day from PAS to Pakatan Harapan.
Yeah, I do agree with Ben that perhaps the word tsunami is not the most accurate term, right? So really, it's about the support being diffused across different states. And as he said, it's not uniform across the country. So each state has its own kind of unique political history, local political history. It's got, you know, its own issues, its own economic conditions and developments. And also, I think it's the strength of the local political actor there. So I think all those different factors, they contribute to perhaps what we are seeing as a swing in terms of Malay support.
And then there's the East Malaysia element, right? Because obviously Sabah, Sarawak will be big players. And I don't know whether the Malay tsunami really applies there, or really it's the whole rural-urban divide in terms of access to information that should be more at play. And also the whole issue of Sabah being hugely fragmented.
Right. But in Sabah, you also have this real pickup in the states-based discourse, the idea of states' rights that we already see quite well established in Sarawak. The expectation that Warisan, because the former, led by the former UMNO bigwig, you know, Shafiq Abdal, he and many other allies of former nemesis come together on the basis of Sabah rights and rights for Sabahan. So we'll see this time round whether that picks up. It's both a state game and Sabah, but it's also a federal game, because the federal game will determine also the final calculus for the formation of the national government.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. One of my friends who is one of those urban people, but is actually very divided. He's one of the fence sitters at this point in time. He actually points out that, you know, Pakatan, it's very much focused on the peninsula. It doesn't have much of a focus on East Malaysia. And until there's a party which focuses on both parts of the pond, you know what I mean?
But you need financial firepower
correct,
for that.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think there's also a debate about whether it needs to. You need to have, you know, PKR or DAP. Because DAP is quite well represented in, say, in both Sarawak and Sabah, and but they have their own kind of characteristics.
Yeah.
As a DAP Sarawak kind of line as well. So we'll see how all this pans out, and whether ultimately, when the chips are down, who gets to form the next government of Malaysia. Stay tuned for more news and analysis, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.